kids. Matt Segundo here, and I apologize for my disappearance. I was busy traveling to the Arctic, trying to find a penguin who would be my bride. Why would I live with an animal? Well, this was of course for tax purposes. As I understand it, our young roaming correspondent was midway through an interview involving a cartoonist who drew penguins, but who couldn't offer any leads. So, I'll let them continue their talk while I nibble on a piece of raw herring.
I read a Publishers Weekly article about a couple of weeks ago, and it said that graphic novel sales were up last year. So maybe the newspaper is not necessarily the place for this. I don't know.
You say graphic novels are up.
Graphic novel sales are up, yeah.
Well, good. Let's bring the graphic novel, let's serialize it and bring it to the newspaper.
Yeah.
It's not going to occur to them because it would be far too risky. And more importantly, they don't have the space to do it anymore. Their ad revenues are down so much. They're cutting back space on anything graphic. Pictures are getting smaller. Comics are getting smaller. So for you to suggest that they rethink entertainment in their page entirely and take all those pages that are now given to editorials and put them toward the graphics, it's not going to fly. So it's not a happy picture for newspapers or the future of comics, obviously.
Well, how can you actually give this newspaper comics section a swift kick in the ass, or how can you reinvigorate it if you have these limitations in place?
You are talking about a perfect vicious circle, and there is no answer. I have great sympathy for editors in not being sympathetic to that argument. Loosen it up, stop living in the Puritan past, attract some younger readers, some hipper folks, and dismiss the complaints that you're inevitably going to get from your very staid older readers. It's a tough, scary call to make. They don't know if it would work, and in the interim, they could lose too many of their older readers that they're probably right on the verge of canceling anyway. And you can't really blame them. I mean, they're just hanging on right now.
Yeah.
So, and frankly, it's really difficult to make a case that you're going to get kids that have never opened a paper in their lives to occur to them to start doing it, to check it out. We've got some new graphics, check it out. The whole idea of holding a huge bundle of dead wood to get your news is going to be so much of an anathema to a 20-year-old kid that I don't think it matters what's actually printed on it. Physically, it doesn't make any sense to them to be reading something physical. Their books are all going to be digital soon, too.
Do you have any objection? I mean, Opus is available on the web through the maincomics.com site. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Does that really actually offer the kind of experience that the newspapers?
No, it doesn't. The comic strips as we've known them in the past are not going to be replaced by the world of digital comics. Graphic humor may move to the computer, but it won't look anything similar. You won't have a Calvin and Hobbes explode into a massive phenomenon with 50 to 70 million readers a year, just because someone's got it on a web blog somewhere.
Yeah.
Comics were a found art. You open the page, you discover Calvin Hobbes for the first time, and know your life's not going to change. You're going to read that every day. Well, you've had to have found it the first time, and it has to be delivered to your doorstep every day. I can't think of a single thing like that on a computer, where everyone is reading the same thing. YouTube has kind of brought it close, but even then, I mean, think, we had readerships of 50 to 100 million people in the 80s and 70s for a given piece of entertainment, a single strip. The same person in Kentucky is going to be reading it. It's the same person in L.A., New York City. You're not going to have that. You're going to, instead of having 75 comic strips with readerships of 20 to 100 million, you're going to have thousands of comic strips with readerships of several hundred to 1,000. That's a sea change in its effect on society. And the pop culture, I think, has an effect. The unifying aspect of pop culture, I think, is overlooked. And we're losing that. We're not all listening to the same music. We're not all reading the same cartoons. We're not laughing at the same joke across the country. It's a unifying aspect of our nation that's passing. It hasn't happened with books and movies yet. And I think they're less threatened than the others. Where it's one of the few mediums, films, one of the few mediums left that a kid in New York City will be enjoying at the same moment a kid in Seattle and a kid in the Deep South and a kid in Hawaii and even around the rest of the world. Music's pretty much done. in that regard, in that unifying aspect. Those kids are all listening to different things now. They're not necessarily listening. They're not rocking to "I Want to Spend the Night with You" from Rolling Stones that summer, when everyone's tapping their toes the same music and being able to get together and kind of commune on shared sensibilities.
You haven't had a mix CD or mixtape given to you lately.
What are you saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that
it's fractured. The music industry is fractured just like the comic strips.
What I'm suggesting, though, is that with the music industry's case, and possibly, you know, with the comic syndication, the control that people had over this kind of thing, and you're right about the movies. On the flip side of this homogenous idea is that you have Garfield doesn't have a chance, perhaps.
There's a flip side to everything. Yes, we will have wonderful opportunities for all those cartoonists who could never have gotten on a cartoon page to have their own cartoon strips and with other people looking at them. That obviously is the flip side, and that's the democratization of an art form. The evil side to that, not evil side, the unfortunate side is that we will lose classics. There won't be classic comic strips coming from the web. I promise you, it's not going to happen. And unless you redefine what classic means, classic meaning 10,000 readers.
Yeah.
Well, classic in the old days meant the entire world was reading Blondie. You know, the entire world. On 1955, the freeways emptied in this country because everyone was home watching Milton Berle on television.
Yeah.
The entire country was laughing at the same thing at the same moment. I think there's power in that, and it's not bad. Does that mean the cost of that is there a whole lot of people weren't allowed on that television? A lot of other talented people who have liked to be in Milton Berle's spot didn't have an opportunity to get on. True. Now everybody can be a star for 5 minutes and have on YouTube and have their video on there. They're on TV. Yes, it's opened it up. It's no longer Milton Berle. But really, what does it all matter now? Because it's not culturally, it's not providing any phenomenon that we can all use as a touchstone that binds us as a culture and as a nation and as a generation, a shared sensibility of something. And Milton Berle's a good example because it was so extreme. The Beatles being enjoyed by kids all around the world. There will never be another Beatles. There will never be, I'm thinking much less than the Beatles. There's too many opportunities now. With the opportunities spread out paper thin, it's eliminating the possibility of great, rare classics.
What of Gnarls Barkley, the Arcade Fire? These are all bands that came into being largely through the internet. They, you know, Gnarls Barkley in that case, Crazy, their single, didn't get any kind of radio airplay. It was entirely internet airplay, and it went to number one.
Okay, compare, if you could measure these things, compare the Q rating of that song to, if you could measure it, the Q rating of I Want to Hold Your Hand in 1964. My mother would have been familiar with that tune. Her parents would have been familiar with it. A six-year-old in Switzerland would have been familiar with it. The entire world would have been singing that. I promise you, even though we're aware, I'm barely aware of that song, but not that aware.
Yeah.
It's a scintilla of a percentage compared to the music that we all thought were hits 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I promise you, you couldn't find, as a cross-section of pop culture across the world, that song is not necessarily, it doesn't measure compared to the songs that everyone was listening to in that time. The problem with this conversation is it sounds like the old guy waving the cane saying the old days need to come back.
No, I mean, to some degree I agree with you, but I'm suggesting actually that it's more of a kind of convergence that we're possibly in, and that maybe when the old model deteriorates, some new model will exist to take its course, and then you will have...
I know that's the great white hope, is that as we shouldn't bemoan the dying of the old days because something new is going to replace it. Well, what's replacing it is something new and exciting and dynamic, but it is completely different, and I think something will be permanently lost forever. There's no way. I mean, give me a scenario where you could have a phenomenon such as the Stones or the Beatles or Elvis Presley I'm thinking about going back.
I went to Coachella a couple years ago for the Arcade Fire, and I saw a band that almost exclusively through word of mouth on the internet. There are like, you know, thousands of people in this audience, and they're all, it's the typical mass concert experience, all clapping their hands, and the Arcade Fire put on a great theatrical show.
How many records are they going to sell?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, as a way to give them a Q rating, I mean...
Yeah.
I mean, yes, they found their fan base.
But maybe it's...
A phenomenon can happen where a group can, from nowhere, without a record company, can be, with the power of the web, just become a raging hit. But I would measure that raging hit compared to what passed as phenomenons in the old days when the Beatles unified the entire world with their... They changed the culture. Mm. They changed how we'd wear our hair and our dress and our clothes and the colors we chose for our Nehru jackets and our religion. Everyone discovered the silly Maharishi yoga or whatever. He changed everything. Elvis changed the way we thought of singers. Their impact was phenomenal. And it was a unifying cohesion to our culture. This group that you mentioned may find their small stadium full of fans, but they're going to be gone in a year, I promise you, and there'll be a new one.
Just had a new album, and it's a hit. So,
all right. Yeah. What span of time are we talking about
this
here?
Like now,
and what
like
effect on our culture are these guys going to have? There'll be flashes of brilliance here and there, and it'll be raging, it'll be fast, and it'll be over, and it'll be on to the next one.
Yeah.
And see if I'm not wrong in 20 years.
Okay, fair.
Who can fill a stadium right now?
Yeah.
Tell me, who can fill a stadium?
Good point.
For the past 15 years, U2, but U2 goes back to 80s. Tell me an act that's come along that can even just put enough people in a stadium that Journey could, for crying out loud, in the 80s.
I tried to actually get tickets in New York for LCD Sound System, and they had like something like three, no, who was it? There was some band, like I was astonished that they had like sold out five shows in a row. Yeah. But then again, that's New York.
Can they fill Shea Stadium?
Well,
can they fill the Astrodome? You know, these groups, even back in the 80s, could do that. That was and that tells you something, that if they can do that, they can probably do that in every American city. And if they can do it in every American city, they can probably go to Europe and do it in Japan. Madonna could do it in the 80s. After that, and when music went digital, and when it got democratized, so that every garage band can make their CD, and they don't have to go through that horrendous, bad, but maybe functional process of filtering that's required to get a music deal in the old days. The thing that everyone bemoans because it's so unfair and it's so undemocratic and only a few get to the top. Without that, everyone gets to play the game, but then no one really plays the game. Maybe that's what I'm saying.
Well, how does this relate? Let's tie this back into the comics. Yeah.
No one's really playing the game. You're not going to get another Bill Watterson on the web. Mm. Ever.
Okay.
Even if he's sitting on the web, he's not going to have 70 million people clicking on his site every day to check him out. Mm-hmm. Unless there's a paradigm that I haven't seen. But at the moment... It only seems to be going in one direction. More and more, less homogeneousness and more targeted demographics. So that I'm going to do a comic strip, but I'm going to do it just for gay podiatrists.
Yeah.
And they're going to think it's hilarious. Yes, it allows the gay podiatrists market to find its potential. And you could never have done... cartoon strip on gay podiatrists in the bad old days when it was ruled by us giants.
Yeah.
Is this a good thing that now we're going to have those strips out there for the 200 or 300 people that might enjoy that? Yes, theoretically that's a great bit of freedom in our country now that in that particular creative genre that's possible. The cost of that is that there's no opportunity for a Calvin and Hobbes to show up in a newspaper and have every person in America find something of value in that, because they would not have discovered it on their own on the web. There was something specific about opening a newspaper page and finding it that can't be reproduced on the psychology of looking at a computer screen and how you find information on a computer screen. That's what can't be changed. And I can't... Of course, it's dangerous saying you'll never, you know, think of all the things that we didn't anticipate with the computer, but it's only getting more democratic. But as it's getting more democratic, we're losing the benefits of the old fascism creatively that we had, where we had to eliminate all the great talent to allow just the bits to get to the top, just the cream to emerge. But when they did, they were fantastic. I mean, the ones that really survived, the Led Zeppelins, the great supergroups of the old days, when the whole world was listening to them, there was a lot of dead bodies behind them never got on that would have gone on, you know, the web if there was such a thing.
Some might also argue that you might necessarily now have replaced the old guard now. And now that you have all this possible web cartoonism of some sort now is in response to you, perhaps, you know?
That's possibly. All of us encouraged by us being there, we encouraged a lot of kids to try cartooning themselves. Yes, it was great that they had, that most of them who were not probably good enough to have gotten a syndication deal and to have had to beat everybody else out on the page and squeeze in and get their space on the page and rise to the top, they now have their opportunity on the web. But our success in those days across a wide spectrum probably encouraged a lot of people to enter the business, and they may have been a circular thing. It encouraged the web to grow too.
Yeah.
In that way. It's happening with filmmakers right now. Everyone's producing stuff for YouTube.
Yeah.
All those filmmakers that never would have had a chance, well, maybe so, but are we going to get a Steven Spielberg again on the web? I don't think so. The movies are still in that Neanderthal way of eliminating everybody else and only allowing a few at the top, as cruel as it is. But they're still allowing the Gore Verbinskis to show up with the Pirates of the Caribbean and blow everybody out of the water. You know?
Yeah. And Spidey 3 recently.
And Spidey 3.
Well, I know you're totally exhausted, so I'll ask you one last question.
Didn't get into your question.
No.
This is what happens.
Yeah,
and I just start yapping and we go off.
Well, I actually wanted to ask you about something specific I've observed in your work, and I actually discovered the answer as to where it came from, but that is characters looking into mirrors are all throughout your work, particularly in the Bloom County stuff, but also in Flawed Dogs you have Pepe looking into a mirror. Now, I wanted to ask you about this, and I discovered that, you know, in near the end of One Last Little Peek, that you had actually were inspired by this 1971 Doonesbury
thing.
There
you go.
Yeah. But I was curious why you keep returning to this, if there's a specific
idea. Well, I certainly don't have the characters talking back from the mirror.
Yeah.
Because that's what got me in trouble with Doonesbury. I mean, he originally had a character in his college strip before Doonesbury, or before the syndicated Doonesbury, talking back to the guy staring in the mirror. And I did the same thing, forgetting that that's where I got the damn idea.
Yeah.
So getting nailed for it. So you're not going to see, hopefully you haven't seen more of my characters talking back, although, you know, I may have used that motif. You're going to probably tell me I have recently.
Well,
where the character in the mirror is talking back to the person looking in the mirror?
It's a lot of it was in Bloom County. I basically went through all your work before I talked with you, and I saw a lot of it in Bloom County, some in the early days of Outland, and then all of a sudden you kind of stopped doing it, and then I'm reading through your children's books, and they're Flawed Dogs.
Yeah, I think you need to stop looking at this stuff too carefully. It gets very dangerous.
Well, I bring this up because I want to, you know, talk to you about this idea of cultural appropriation. I mean, is it fair for Trudeau to, you know, I'm not sure if you guys are even on speaking terms at all still, but...
Well, he won't talk to me. I'd be happy to talk to him.
Yeah. But, I mean, is it fair, though, for him to accuse you of appropriation from him when he has essentially done the same thing with the Duke character, which is based on Hunter S. Thompson? I mean, don't you have to kind of reproduce in order to kind of discover how you operate?
Look, he sent me... We had a long exchange of letters in the beginning when in the first year of Bloom... my strip of Bloom County, some of my characters were even looking too much like his, and they were actually patterned too closely to his. This is the first year. I've thrown them all out. The whole first year of Bloom County has never been reproduced in a book.
Yeah.
Too many mistakes. I used several of Gary's gags from his college years, because that's the strips that I studied carefully when I was trying to figure out how to do a comic strip back when I was in college. And a few of his jokes seeped into my consciousness, and I showed up in Bloom County the first year, but also some of my characters started getting patterned too closely on his. I would be surprised if you can find any motifs that I use now that you could imagine him complaining about.
Well,
20 years later, I'd be shocked if you could point something that I may have characters looking in mirrors, but they're not. Specifically, his gag was the guy's reflection talking back at him and telling him he's an idiot.
Yeah.
I definitely did that a couple of times that first year and got slapped for it.
Yeah.
And in the midst of some conversations he and I were having about all this, he wrote me, I think he wrote me a Christmas card one time as sort of a peace offering. And he said, listen, don't sweat it too much. All art is a synthesis of what's gone on before.
Yeah.
And that was his quote from someone else, actually. And he was admitting himself, of course, that he'd come from the world of Jules Pfeiffer and, in a way, Peanuts and other strips that especially political ones that had come before. So he admitted, certainly, we're all of our styles are built on the shoulders of other guys that have gone before us. It's that delicate gray area that all cartoonists complain about. It's a running thing in graphic novels. Everyone's always accusing somebody of stealing somebody's style and moves and postures and characters and approaches, and color and style. But I would be very surprised if you could find any motifs in mine now that look like I'm still churning on something that I'd seen in his strip that he would even complain about now. I would have heard from him or other people.
Yeah.
But I had so few influences, it would have to be either him or... I mean, now I might be borrowing things from famous painters.
Yeah.
Borrowing. Stealing.
Yeah.
Thievery.
Well, you know, Picasso said, you know, great art, you know, good artists steal, great artists plagiarize.
Yeah, there you go. If I was painting and I was having trouble with a pose with a human, I'm happy to go back into 19th century painters and find that pose, that person standing with that waist, so I know where an elbow is and where a neck is compared to that elbow, and I'll just draw that figure and not feel a bit guilty about it. Be happy to do it with a model, but it just takes too much time. So we all still definitely building on what's happened before. But there is an area you can't step over. Definitely rewriting gags you've read in other strips is a no-no, and I definitely did that first year. But designing a character, I had a character that was way too close to, not surprisingly, Hunter Thompson.
Yeah.
Clearly bad news. That was the first year, like first 6 months of Lumen, 1981, I think.
Wow.
And Gary pointed out, he's deeply annoyed. And I had absolutely no defense. I looked at it and says, you're absolutely right. I'm getting lazy and not trying to reinvent it myself. I'm watching a half dozen strips in the paper right now, spinning on motifs and areas that I mostly explored. I mean, no one had an animal that talked to people in a comic before I did it. It just didn't happen. Animals talk to other animals. You never cross that invisible wall. The page is filled with dogs and cats talking to their owners now. Would that have occurred to them if they hadn't seen Opus for 20 years? Probably not. But I don't care. That's part of the game. You know, you change the landscape a little bit, and now everyone else is walking on it, so it's okay.
I'll ask you one last question, and then...
Sure, I feel bad that you didn't get to nearly
questions. No, it's okay. These things happen. And then I've talked with a couple of cartoonists. Allison Bechtel and Alex Robinson basically told me that... For them, they turned to cartooning because they were okay writers and okay artists, and that cartooning was sort of a kind of synthesis of the two. And I was wondering if that was a similar case with you. What was the ratio between narrative and art for all of your stuff?
Well, we always used to say that the cartoon is a perfect refuge for the mildly talented in any one of those two disciplines of writing and drawing, and the evidence is overwhelming. It's everywhere. I mean, Peanuts is an example of sloppy drawing and very simplistic writing. It's a perfect comic strip. You can't get better than the 50 years of Peanuts. Charles Schulz probably would have been ruined if he had been a more elegant writer and a more skilled writer. The strip would have been hopelessly muddled if he was able to draw anything. The man couldn't draw very well. This coming together was that perfect storm of mistakes that makes perfection. And there's not many areas that that works in other than comics, although you could argue that it happens in music too. I mean, I doubt Louie Louie was done by people who could play their instruments particularly well. I mean, they had three chords, right?
Yeah.
But it came together, and if those guys had the skills of Mozart, they never would have done Louie Louie. And maybe it works the same way with cartoons. It's a perfect refuge for those of us who aren't very good at this. And it does attract plenty of sloppy writers and poor artists. I actually surprised myself that I could draw better than I thought I could. I mean, when I started Bloom County, it was really, really bad. It was drawn very poorly. And it was overwritten horrifically. It wasn't until I got serious about it and actually tried that I discovered I can draw a little bit. I'm working on it. Yeah, that's looking like a human face, more than it did last week. And I got better. But she's right. It's a perfect place to go for people who aren't shining in any one of those two areas, because it lets you slide considerably. And in fact, it's almost a benefit to be not overburdened with excellence, which sometimes can be distracting, because it forces you back into kind of base instincts about themes, about emotions, gags. You can easily overwrite a gag with too much verbiage. It's classic overwriting. You don't want Christopher Hitchens writing a comic strip.
That would be a good interesting.
He's a wonderful writer.
Yeah.
But the whole thing would be so damn verbose that we'd be snoring by the end of the time we. So
I was curious what he would draw. He was the same guy who wrote an essay that said women aren't funny.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he did. He'd be thrown out of paper faster than me. No, the comics wasn't made for Hitchens.
I want to actually ask you about surreal humanism. I would actually identify...
Surreal humanism?
Surreal humanism are two words I would use to define your work. And that is because I observed in, like, Outland, that's when the surreal aspect kind of came out.
Yeah, but it didn't last long.
It didn't last long, no. But then it kind of came back a little bit, and this humanistic aspect came with Opus. And I was wondering if these two words have occurred to you in the process.
Have not occurred to me. Certainly, the only thing interesting about the first year of Outland was it revealed... a great level of naivete on my part about how the psychology of comics works. I presumed, again, naively, that your readers, just like a musician would assume, that their fans are going to go on any artistic journey that they're going to go on and they're going to follow. Well, they don't. And this is proven over and over and over, and much to the shock of a lot of artists or musicians, that... God, they've got this new edgy experimental new album, and they go to the concert and they keep wanting me to play my old standard hits from 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And they get all upset about it. Well, they're stupid for falling into that trap. And I was stupid in assuming that I could reinvent my style, which the style that I was wanting to reinvent, I was extraordinarily fortunate to have become such a success. Well, at that point, you don't take things for granted, and you also don't pretend that you're in anything except for extremely populist entertainment. This is all about entertaining your reader. It's not about redefining an art form. So I was bored. I was wanting to try some really cool stuff graphically. Quickly became apparent that it might have worked 20 years before. It was not going to work in 1995. And I enjoyed it, but I was going into territory that was disappointing to people who, just like in a television show, you don't want to change all the characters in a hit television show just because you want to get experimental.
After MASH or something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a classic mistake of an artist assuming that they can reinvent their own wheel and everyone still wants to take a ride on it. And I regrouped and decided to go back to what I was more comfortable with. And I didn't want to disappoint readers. It's not about dragging them along on a creative joyride with me. Comic strip is classic populist entertainment. You are there to provide what people are expecting every day, and that is the comfort of familiarity. That's what comic strips are all about. That's why we still found it entertaining every time Charlie Brown had Lucy set up the football and would try to kick it. We knew what was going to happen. We knew that Charlie Brown was going to end up on his back. If he ever did kick that football, that would be a controversial thing to do, and it would be an unpleasant experience for the readers.
Yeah.
Because you've set up that paradigm, and if people could parse their feelings about comics, which most people can't, certainly I couldn't because I was never a huge fan of them, but as I've come to understand doing them, you're providing a comfort in people's lives on a daily basis, not once a week like I'm doing my Sunday. I can't work on that function. When I gave up my daily strip, I gave up that huge component of cartooning, which is that daily entry into their front door over their cup of coffee and delivering something that they're really relatively familiar with, and it is a comfort. In a world that everything else is changing, the fact that Charlie Brown's never going to kick that football felt good to people. They understand the gag, and they would have been disturbed if he had. Bloom County, as shaped by the neck attitude that it had, still had elements in it that people didn't want to leave behind. They didn't want to see Opus turn into a wholly different character. They didn't want to see a character arc for Opus and have him end up a completely smart guy without an ounce of naivete in him with a lot of teenage attitude. If you do that, you're just cutting your own throat. And if you don't approach the art form with appreciating that and feeling that you're above it and that it's stayed and it's all stodgy and it's old-fashioned to keep delivering basically reasonably about the same thing without getting boring, but without completely reinventing, as artists are prone to do, then you've chosen the wrong art form.
And yet with Opus, however, the paradigm that you've set up has evolved, has changed. You've had the characters grow older. You've had, we haven't seen Binkley or Milo Bloom.
Binkley's coming back in a week or two, but I have not aged him. And it was a conscious decision. I couldn't bring Steve Dallas back without aging him, because inevitably I was going to be running through a lot of stuff happening in my life, and I needed a character to do that in besides Opus. Mm-hmm. And so I've got Steve Dallas and his son, Augie, and as I was a new parent, I would be a fool not to have a paradigm that I could feed a few of my experiences into. So I made Steve Dallas older, but I wouldn't bring Binkley back as a teenager. God knows, we'd all be sick to our stomachs. And I certainly don't want to draw anybody as a teenager in the comic strips, and I would have to match him. But so I'm letting that one slide. Inevitably, your characters change. You cannot stop it. You look at Peanuts. Snoopy was not the same character that in 1959 that he was in 1968. Mm-hmm. He went through a metamorphosis. You have to let yourself change a little bit, but as you're changing, you have to realize what people are latching on to, and you have to be careful not to change that. You wouldn't want Snoopy to suddenly have become too self-aware or change his fundamental aspects of his personality once he became beloved. And that's when you have to be cognizant of what's going on in the strip from a dynamic point of view and realize what other people are getting. This is why I go out on book tours now, because it's the only time I talk to people to read the damn thing. I live in a town where it's not read. So I write it and it goes out, and it's the visceral impression is that it's going out into the ether.
Yeah.
And I forget millions of people are still reading it, and it still means something to them, and I need to hear it back from them.
Yeah.
I thought that one was funny. My boss thought that one was funny. I talked to someone at Starbucks who was on a conference call with Howard Schultz, and I had just done a Starbucks cartoon. Mm-hmm. And she gave me an insight as to what everyone was talking about in Starbucks about that cartoon and what Howard Schultz thought. Huh. Great feedback. I wouldn't know it until I went out and did the strange thing called a book tour and actually meet the fans, which there's no opportunity to as a cartoonist.
But doesn't feedback kind of get in the way of, I guess, these kinds of very clear artistic decisions you make when you go ahead and prepare a strip?
No, that's my point. It's populist entertainment. I want to know what they think is funny. Mm-hmm. I want to know what storylines that they're not following or they are following. Email has helped that in some ways, but in other ways, the mail I'm getting is not like the physical mail that used to come. I haven't gotten a letter in 4 or 5 years. And I was inundated with mail during the 80s. I mean, I had to hire people to answer it and open it, physical letters. And in those days, when people went to all the trouble to send a letter and put it in an envelope and stamp it, they wrote you a real letter. Yeah. And they wrote about it and wrote about how it's working in their lives and how it helped them through a bad time. And the stuff that they thought was funny and they talked about the characters as fans do is real. Email now is so abbreviated that people aren't used to writing at length and being thoughtful with it. So it's a different kind of message you're getting back. So when you get people in front of you at a signing table and they're excited to meet you and tell you about what the strip has been providing them in their lives as both entertainment and in a bit of enlightenment or getting them through a dark period, you do factor that in. And I'm happy to roll it back and fold it into what I'm doing now and moving on with it. Mm-hmm. and letting it affect the strip.
Gotcha.
It's an organic thing. Again, it's when you start thinking that you're the artist and everyone needs to follow you no matter where you're going, that's when you've made a mistake. So, and there's plenty of cartoons that get caught in that trap, or all kinds of popular artists.
The African-American characters in your strips throughout the years,
that many.
Well, there are, but compared to, like, you know, say the rest of the comics page, aside from Franklin from Peanuts or Wee Pals, there's very little of that going on. So I'm wondering, you know, was this kind of an effort on your part to really kind of, I guess, shake up this Caucasian mentality of the comics page?
Oh, well, obviously when you have an ensemble strip, yeah, you do want a little diversity. I wanted, more than I wanted a black character, I wanted a kid interested in science.
Yeah.
Because I'm interested in science. And I love the idea of corrupting science into mischievous ways. It's just a comic motif that amuses me. So when it came time to bring in a character that represented an overly bright, pinheaded, scientific kid that's getting in trouble with his skills, by my nature, I always go counter to expectations. So I made him black kid. Now, it's gotten even worse with African-American kids now in emphasizing schooling and science and learning. It's become uncool in that culture.
Yeah.
So I thought it was funnier if I was going to have a particularly schooled kid, a bookish egghead kid, to make them the one thing you don't see emphasized in popular culture too much, and it probably could use a little. So I thought it was just fun to have them as a black kid, and having them integrated in with the rest of the kids, being the smartest kid on the strip. Yeah. Still funny. I mean, he's not a straight man. Too many TV shows at that time were bringing in black characters to their ensemble pieces, and they would give them nothing funny to do because they were terrified.
Yeah.
And he would become the one straight character in the show, which was pathetically bad decision making.
Yeah.
And cowardly.
Well, the other thing too is you were ahead of your time with the Banana Junior computer, because Apple has transformed into a, you're going to be different by adhering to Apple in a way that, you know,
haven't seen. Was easy to see. Yeah. But what I didn't anticipate is Microsoft using the Banana 6000 as a little avatar, that little icon that they have that comes up and dances when something is wrong or do you have a question. And I thought they should have at least asked before they did that. I mean, I've occasionally been in the same room with Bill Gates, and I know he would completely deny that they did that on purpose. But as much as I annoyed him in the early 90s,
well,
I can't believe that they didn't do it on purpose.
Some of the geeks who worked at Microsoft had read Bloom County over there.
Oh, I'm sure a few of them did over there in Seattle.
Yeah, gotcha. It was a great pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, it's great.
You
great
look
fun.
Like you're going to collapse, but thank
oh,
you.
Oh, I'm not that bad.
No.
Oh,
but,
think of the
but,
picture that people
yeah,
have
no,
now.
No. But you have been like just boom, boom, boom all day. So, I mean, you know, it's. I'm not suggesting that you're not a virile man. But
thank you.
It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much for